So how do you think the credit bureau Equifax handled the news of that massive security breach where the personal information of some 143 million Americans was stolen? And what do you think should happen to Equifax as a result? I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We are going to take a step back this hour to get a sense of how and why Equifax had all that information in the first place and learn about the workings of and the power of the credit bureau system. And we will welcome your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. By the way, our guest this hour is not a financial planner, so maybe save those questions for another time. We did cover the what to do in terms of your personal finances during On Your Money yesterday. There is an article with Kevin McKinley's advice on it on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We have a new Facebook page, the Ideas Network, so you can go there and check it out. And you can also post a comment about the issue if you'd like to do that as well. Let me welcome our guest. Josh Lauer is an associate professor of media studies at the University of New Hampshire. His areas of expertise include consumer and financial culture and surveillance. He is the author of the book Creditworthy, A History of Consumer Surveillance and Financial Identity in America. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you say that this Equifax security breach was a long time coming. Why do you say that?
Well, I mean, for the people who are concerned about losing their credit data today, the history may not seem as important, but actually credit bureaus have been around for a really long time, and they've been collecting a lot of very intimate, deeply personal information for a long time, and these files have built up over, you know, over 100 years. And so, it, you know, it's not surprising that there might be problems if that information were to leak out. And, of course, now that all this information is in computers and databases, you know, can be hacked into, unfortunately, it puts all of that information at risk.
I was shocked to learn that, you just said it, the credit bureaus have been around for more than 100 years. What in the world? When did they start?
So the first bureaus devoted to collecting information about individual consumers appeared around 1870 in the New York City area. And these were generally, you know, smallish groups that were organizing, trying to get information about neighborhood customers who were, you know, shopping at the grocery store, and especially by the later part of the 1800s in big department stores. And it's, you know, the same problem we have today. You know, you go into a store, the store doesn't know you personally, they don't know your personal history. And the same thing was happening at the end of the 1800s. You have more strangers who were asking for credit, and the credit bureaus became a way to centralize information about people's identities, where they lived, where they worked, how much money they had, how they paid their bills. And it quickly became very popular, and credit bureaus started to spread throughout the country within the last few decades of the 1800s. And by the beginning of the 20th century, you had a national association and hundreds of credit bureaus throughout the country. And these, you know, these were not organizations that were, you know, completely incapable of collecting information. They're quite sophisticated. They had rooms filled with filing cabinets. They had, you know, lots of people working phones, receiving calls from department stores, installment dealers, hospitals, asking for information about people's creditworthiness. And it became, you know, a major industry pretty quickly in the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about the evolution of the credit bureau system, and maybe some about what's going to be the future of the credit bureau system. But let me get your reaction to the whole Equifax breach. It happened this spring. The company didn't tell us about it for a few weeks at least, maybe several weeks. What do you make of how Equifax has handled this matter?
I think most people would agree that they did not handle it very well. At minimum, people are upset that there was a delay between when the hacks were discovered and when they were announced. Then, of course, there was the controversy about offering a credit monitoring service that, in the process of signing up for, you would sign away your right to sue them or have some sort of legal action against them in the future. And then, of course, there were more snafus with the credit freezes. So Equifax has definitely not gotten out ahead of this. But, you know, it points to a bigger problem that, you know, these organizations, there are three major credit bureaus in the United States, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, and they have an incredible amount of information about us, and we can't opt out of these credit bureaus. They're really important in our economy. They're really important to lenders, and, you know, if there's a problem, you can't say, well, Equifax, you know, you've done me wrong, and I want to go to another credit bureau, or I want to take my data out of your hands. It just doesn't work that way. So that the problem is not just that a big database has been breached, because that kind of thing happens quite often, but it's a database of information that we have no choice but to be included in.
Yeah, and that amazes me too. But so is anybody overseeing Equifax? I mean, is Equifax in danger of going out of business?
I would be surprised by that, but they are certainly in danger of attracting a lot of attention from policymakers, lawmakers. The credit bureaus pretty much ran without regulation until the late 1960s, and then there were some important events and investigations in Congress and resulted in the Fair Credit Reporting Act in 1970. And that was the first major pieces of legislation to try to keep tabs on the credit bureaus. There have been other laws that have been passed, you know, throughout the end of the 20th century and into the 21st century, you know, giving consumers other rights. But in general, you know, the credit bureaus are self-policing in terms of their security, their responsibility with all of this data. They're, as far as I know, are not auditors or regulators who are spending a lot of time policing the security protocols of credit bureaus. So that might change. I mean, I think that, you know, it's entirely possible that there might be a new round of regulations that come to a head because of this particular breach.
Yeah. You say that the three main credit reporting bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, are that they care more about businesses than individual consumers like us. Why do you say that?
Well, the credit bureau came into being to protect businesses from people who were either not paying their bills or paying them too slowly, and there was no way to sort of force them to settle up. So the credit bureaus, you know, emerged to help businesses. They weren't founded to help consumers, and so their history is really as an advocate for business. And even today, we can see how that, you know, that disposition still plays out. I mean, the credit bureaus are most concerned about making sure that their data is accurate and available for, you know, lenders, retailers, other businesses that want to use their services. But, you know, whether or not consumers are happy with the service or, you know, how angry they might be about what the credit bureaus are doing is not their foremost concern.
Yeah. Has there ever been any movement toward a more customer or consumer-first credit bureau?
That's a great question. There have certainly have been efforts to get credit bureaus to be more consumer friendly. Whether or not there is, you know, some future consumer credit bureau that has consumers in mind is, I guess, an open question. But, you know, the difficulty right now and in the immediate future is trying to get credit bureaus to be responsive to consumers rather than making it difficult for them to have some sense of what's in their file. What's the status of the records that they're holding, and, you know, whether or not they can trust that that their financial identities are safe.
Yeah. We have just a minute before a news break and lots of time after that, but let me just share at this point Cindy on Facebook, who says she's had two credit cards stolen and was upset when Yahoo was hacked. She goes on to say, "We are all bound to be hacked at some point. There is no safe place anymore except off the grid." What's your reaction to that?
Unfortunately, I think that's that's accurate. I think it's really hard to expect 100% security in, you know, the contemporary environment where so much of our data is moving through computers, and no human system is fail-proof. And, you know, there are always innovative and creative, clever hackers who are wanting to find ways to break into these systems. But the problem with the credit bureau is that, you know, it has the sort of crown jewels of our financial identities, whereas, you know, if you lose a credit card, yes, that's, you know, that's an inconvenience and stressful, but you call the bank, they cancel the card, and they don't charge you for the purchases that were made by someone else.
Yeah. We'll follow up after we check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then we'll continue talking with Josh Lauer, who is the author of the book Credit Worthy, talking about the credit bureau system. This is the Ideas Network. We are following up on the Equifax security breach that affected 143 million Americans, and talking about how we arrived at the three major credit reporting bureaus, the pluses and minuses for consumers, and some about what the future may hold for the way our credit information is managed. And we're welcoming your questions. We're welcoming your reactions. How upset are you with Equifax? What do you want to see happen when it comes to not only Equifax, but the whole credit system? Our guest is Josh Lauer. He's an associate professor of media studies at the University of New Hampshire. His book is Credit Worthy, A History of Consumer Surveillance and Financial Identity in America. If you have a question, 1-800-642-1234. We have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Lots of people on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page really incensed Josh over what has happened with Equifax and how Equifax has handled it. I mean, just outraged. We've had also people on this program in the past saying, why in the world do these three companies have so much power over us? Let's break that down a little bit. Why do we have three bureaus, credit bureaus?
Well, and before answering that question, we should really emphasize that the credit bureaus are also very helpful to us, and their existence is in our interest in a lot of ways. You know, you can try to imagine a world where you couldn't get instant credit, a world where if you wanted to get a loan, you had to wait for days or weeks until an investigation was completed into your background. All the things that, you know, we take for granted in the modern digital economy sort of rests on this infrastructure mm-hmm. of credit reporting. It's in the background. So, you know, we can be really mad at credit bureaus, and we should be mad at Equifax for this particular breach. But in some ways, you know, we should appreciate that, you know, there is a clearinghouse that makes all this so efficient and so, you know, possible for us. And the other thing, you know, I would say is that Americans have a long history of forgetting about credit bureaus and their importance. So for many, many years, credit bureaus tried really hard to publicize their role in the economy and what they were doing in their communities, and most people didn't pay much attention. And then during the 1960s, it became a big issue and sort of went away again. And it, you know, obviously it comes up periodically when there's a major problem or when, you know, there's an issue about identity theft and how to deal with that.
Yeah, well, we'll get back to how we came to have three of them. But when you bring up a good point that if we want a loan, maybe you could just how does this work? So my credit union's going to check my the three credit bureaus to make sure that I've been paying my bills on time and what my credit rating is, and that's going to help them determine whether I should get that loan or not.
Yeah, well, so basically, if you've ever had any credit relationship, I mean, you know, whether you have a credit card, you know, have had some sort of loan in the past, you will be entered into probably all three of the major credit bureaus. A file will be opened about you. And, you know, basically what happens is that major lenders, financial institutions, retailers, even insurance companies, if you're, you know, paying them over time, they report automatically in regular intervals all the information that they have about their individual customers, and that information is aggregated in the credit bureaus. The credit bureaus become basically a clearinghouse for all of our payment histories and information about the kinds of accounts we have, the kinds of debts that we have. And then this information can be used, you know, when someone wants to see if they want to offer you a credit card or offer you a loan, they can contact the credit bureau and either look at a credit report or, in many cases, the information that credit bureaus have in their files is used in credit models to produce credit scores, and there are a variety of different scores, but you know, we're generally familiar with the three-digit number that sort of summarizes our credit risk, and that's produced by information that the credit bureaus keep and then run through these credit scoring models.
Yeah, and you're saying if we didn't have these system, these credit bureaus, that it would take many days or even weeks to get that loan or credit card?
Yes. So, I mean, that's, you know, always the problem. There was a newspaper article that I remember reading in the 1960s about how consumers, you know, they shop around for weeks for a new television, but when they want to buy it, they want it that day. And, you know, that's the way that many of us are. I mean, when we're ready to make a purchase and we want to either, you know, use a credit card or, you know, buy it over time, you know, we want to leave that day with the item, and retailers want to sell us that item that day. They don't want to give us time to go home and think about it some more. And so the credit bureaus, you know, provide this information very quickly to retailers and, you know, to banks and other financial institutions so that the transaction can happen right away. And, you know, I mean, that's sort of the in-store version of it. But, I mean, think about all the commerce that happens online with people using credit cards. Well, you know, the way that you can get a credit card quickly, the fact that you can get a credit card with, you know, often, you know, a reasonable interest rate has a lot to do with the existence of credit bureaus. Because if every bank had to go and investigate your background, that makes the price of the loan, the price of the credit card, much more expensive. So in a lot of ways, you know, we all benefit from credit bureaus as long as they're functioning appropriately and they're protecting our data. If they don't do those things, then we have a bigger problem.
Right. Well, you'd mentioned that the first credit bureau was, in New York in 1870. Then throughout the 20th century, there were hundreds of credit bureaus. Now there are three. How did that happen?
So that's really the result of computers. It turns out that there were hundreds and thousands, even credit bureaus throughout the country. Many cities had more than one credit bureau. During the 1960s, for example, San Francisco had over 20 different credit bureaus just in San Francisco. So you can imagine if you wanted to give someone credit, you might have to check up to 20 different credit bureaus to figure out, you know, to make sure you had all of the information. So in some ways, having fewer credit bureaus is actually more efficient. Rather than having to check a whole bunch of different bureaus scattered all around the town or even around the country. So there were all these different bureaus, and during the middle of the 1960s, some bureaus in the industry began to put their files on computers, and within 10, 15 years, the industry was sort of whittled down to five major computerized bureaus, and then a few years later, three major bureaus, the bureaus that exist today. And basically what happened is, you know, to computerize all of your records is very expensive, to buy the equipment to do that work, and not all of the bureaus could afford to do that. Many of them were smaller operations in the suburbs. They didn't have a lot of capital to invest. And so as a few, you know, large computerized bureaus began to accumulate files, they just started to gobble up all of the local bureaus, and eventually, you know, we're left with the three today.
We are taking a look at how America's credit bureaus work with our guest, Josh Lauer, who is the author of Credit Worthy, A History of Consumer Surveillance and Financial Identity in America. We welcome your questions for him. Maybe your thoughts or reactions to what happened with Equifax and the data breach. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We have some callers, so let's go to John in Milwaukee first. Hi, John.
Hi, how's it going? Yeah, I had a question. Why are all three of those scores not the same? The one that you get for free says you have a 600 score, but the one that they check you on says you have a 300 score and you don't qualify.
Hmm. So are the numbers different at the different bureaus, Josh?
Yeah, that's a great question. So all the credit bureaus have very similar information about each of us. So, you know, your credit card accounts and your balances and how you've paid over time, that's pretty similar in all the different bureaus. But each of the different bureaus has a different kind of credit model. There are other vendors who make credit models that are a little bit different. So basically the formula they're using might be a little bit different. They might weigh different variables slightly different. So you can get a variety of numbers. And also, the information is constantly changing. So the credit bureaus are constantly receiving updated information about your accounts and kinds of accounts that you have. And so it's conceivable that there are gaps in the uploads or in the times that the information is transferred, and that can also affect the specifics of your score.
Yeah, it's and it's kind of we're advised on a periodic basis, and especially after some sort of a security hack, to check the credit bureaus on a regular basis to see if there's any suspicious activity. And that, boy, it's like you have to go to each one of them and go through everything they have. I mean, it's kind of cumbersome for the consumer.
It is, and that gets back to the problem of the bureaus not really being oriented towards consumers, because it's easy to imagine a situation where everyone gets free credit monitoring service, and where it's easy to have some sort of way to continuously log in and monitor what's going on with your credit information and your financial identity, but unfortunately, those have been packaged as add-on services that consumers can buy, that you can subscribe to. And then it puts a lot of the responsibility for monitoring your financial information on the consumer, which, in some ways is not always fair, especially because it is complicated. And there are, multiple agencies that are, controlling this information. I can see how it could be very confusing for consumers and a chore.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, we just lost a caller I was going to go to next, and I wish I knew his specific question, but he said that, he was going to make a point about the actual hack and how we have faulty technical security here. Can you address that at all?
Well, from what I understand of the hack, it wasn't a super sophisticated hack in terms of, they didn't have to dig very hard into the public-facing website to get this information, which is extremely alarming because, again, these are organizations that have very sensitive personal information, financial information. You would expect, their system to be like Fort Knox. But obviously that wasn't the case. And, I think, given the circumstances, the numbers of files that were stolen and the number of people that could potentially be affected, and also the public uproar about this particular hack, it's not inconceivable that there could be changes afoot.
Yeah. How does the credit bureau collect all this information? I mean, how does it know if I paid my utility bill on time, or if I got a car loan or whatever? I mean, everything is on there.
It's true. So, I mean, just use the example, of a credit card, which is maybe the most familiar example. You pay your credit card, you pay your balance once a month, or you pay it all in full. And that kind of account is, a kind of account that is, different from a mortgage. It's different from an auto loan. So there are different varieties of accounts. It's different from a store credit card, for example. And this kind of information, the business that you're paying automatically communicates this information to the three credit bureaus on a regular basis, whether it's once a month or more frequently. So the information is coming directly from the people that you owe money to or that you have some sort of business relationship. The credit bureaus don't have to go out into the world and do investigations. It's a cooperative network, including all of the lenders and retailers and other organizations that have some sort of credit relationship with you.
Yeah. Oh, Matt from Wausau emails, I received my 9-digit Social Security number in 1966. It's 2017. I think we should be able to do better than a 9-digit number to secure all of our personal information. Most websites won't even accept such a simplistic pattern for a password. You have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it is a big problem. And that's, you know, it's another problem that has, you know, roots that go back quite a ways. So when the credit bureaus began to computerize, and especially as they began to consolidate and become national rather than, you know, these sort of local organizations scattered in cities and towns throughout the country, it became very obvious that they needed some sort of, you know, unique identifier for every person, because, you know, JCPenney and Sears and, you know, banks all had their own systems for identifying their customers, their own codes and alphanumeric systems, but, you know, that they needed one that would sort of be consistent through all of their systems, and, you know, the Social Security number was sort of an obvious choice. Around the time that the credit bureaus were consolidating and computerizing, the banking industry also shifted over to Social Security numbers. They decided this is the number that they're going to use, and once that happened in the banking industry, the credit bureaus quickly followed suit. But, you know, obviously it's a huge problem because, you know, if a number of people have pointed out, you know, if something happens, you know, you can't change your Social Security number, you can't change your birth date. That I think that, you know, is another issue that this particular hack has highlighted, and, you know, it's causing people to rethink seriously.
Yeah. You know, as we started the program with the negative press that Equifax has received for the hack and the way it handled the situation, and people are worried about how their information is now compromised. And this is not something that just, I don't know, checking your credit monitoring for a year is going to take care of necessarily. This is something that might affect us for the rest of our lives.
That's the big concern, because, yeah, you know, once your information is out there, you know, the thieves might not use it in the next 6 months or 12 months. It could be out there circulating on the dark web. Somebody could sell this information 3 years from now. And, you know, maybe your credit monitoring service has expired, or, you know, you've sort of forgotten about it. And then it could come back to bite you.
Yeah. Let's go to Wanda in Fond du Lac. Hi, Wanda.
Yeah, I just, I'm old school, and I still, you know, write a check out, send the bill, and I look at my invoices and go through stuff. But my son, he's like, what do they call him, millennial, and, you know, they have that direct deposit. And I hand him his mail, and he never looks at it. He never opens any of his bills. He's like, and he laughs at me when he sees me going through, what, you know, paying bills, and he goes, well, I have mine all direct deposit. I just thought, you know, you guys, people should put out a warning for some of these younger kids that do have direct deposit and they're paying their credit cards off directly and they don't look at their statements.
Yeah, are those online millennials in any greater danger as far as you know, Josh?
Well, I mean, they could certainly use some education. I'm similar in some ways. You know, I'm a little bit old school. I still write checks, even though I know that I could just, you know, have them processed automatically online. And I don't know why I do that. I just do that still, like other people. But this kind of, you know, problem also, you know, in this circumstance, I've heard a lot of people talk about, you know, they use cash or they sort of want to go off the grid or they want to retreat somehow to regain some control over their credit identities. But it's really difficult to do because, you know, even if you pay with cash or, you know, pay with checks, it's very hard to live without at least one credit card, you know, because at some point you might have to buy something online or you might want to rent a car. And, you know, you can't do these things with cash. So if you have one credit card, you know, that's all it takes, and you are going to be, you know, completely part of the credit bureau surveillance system, and you're going to have a file somewhere.
We're going to check news again from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we will talk more about the credit bureaus. You're You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Josh Lauer, an associate professor of media studies at the University of New Hampshire. His areas of expertise include consumer and financial culture and surveillance. He is the author of the book Credit Worthy, A History of Consumer Surveillance and Financial Identity in America, which came out this summer, and we thought it would be good to talk to him now that we are reading so much about the Equifax data breach, the security breach that affected 143 million of us, and maybe more than that. He says that this was a long time coming. And we are welcoming your questions for him, and we are welcoming any experiences you might have had with the Equifax or the credit reporting bureaus. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Well, Josh, talk about timing. You come out with your book, and then this happens. This is the first time I remember ever hearing one of these credit bureaus being hacked, isn't it?
It's unfortunate, and I've been working on this book for a while now, and there are always stories in the news where there's a problem with financial identity, or there's a problem with credit scoring, or problem with credit and credit worthiness in general. So what seems like great timing is, you know, actually a topic that is important, and it's always important.
Right, exactly. But we have so many callers. A lot of people have some real specific questions about how this works, and you're okay with that, right, Josh?
Sure.
Jillian in Madison is with us. Hi, Jillian.
Good morning. My question is, I have for the last 2 years had all three of my accounts frozen, and so I thought that I would be safe with Experian, with Equifax, but I went online, and I was told or that I may have been compromised. Could that be possible, even although my account was frozen?
Unfortunately, yes, because the information was taken directly from the bureaus. So the bureaus, you know, have frozen access to credit information from outside, you know, from other people trying to reach in, other organizations trying to reach in. But the credit bureaus themselves still have the data behind that freeze. And, you know, if the hackers got into their system, the freeze really doesn't help you much, unfortunately.
Right, you can't freeze the information from a hacker.
Right.
Yeah. And what does that freeze mean exactly? I mean, the freeze means that if somebody who's not me says, I want to open up a credit card, it's going to, because if I put a freeze on my credit my credit information, they're going to say, sorry, no, you can't open a credit card because this information is frozen.
Exactly. So it essentially means that there can be no new inquiries because the information is frozen. So if someone tries to open a credit account, using your name, and that's obviously the threat that somebody would use your information, your social security number to try to open an account, they would automatically not be able to do that because the account is frozen, the information is frozen. And then, you know, if you changed your mind, or if there, you know, you wanted to open an account, you can unfreeze it, and then the bank or the credit card company can get that information to open the account, the information that they need. But while it's frozen, there should not be any new inquiries that are processed using your information.
Yeah. So how come I have to, in most cases, pay $10 to the credit bureaus to freeze my information and then $10 to unfreeze it?
Well, that's, you know, another open question that, again, gets back to, you know, the idea that the bureaus really aren't there to serve consumers. I mean, you know, from the credit bureau's perspective, credit monitoring services, offering freezing and unfreezing services, these are, you know, new streams of revenue. It's basically a way for credit bureaus to have more income generated from their information. The way that credit bureaus make money is by, you know, charging businesses for their services. And again, they're not oriented towards consumers, but in the last 20 years or so, credit bureaus began to realize that, oh, well, consumers, you know, they also want access to their information, and we can sell them services as well. But, you know, from our perspective, from the consumer's perspective, that, you know, has been described by others as a kind of protection racket, which is really not liked very much.
Yeah. So our financial planner that we speak with every week advised us that we should freeze our credit reports, that we should do that in light of this Equifax breach, because it's one of the few things we can do. Equifax was offering a free monitoring, but that's different than a freeze, isn't it?
Yes, it's different from a freeze. And, you know, I've heard that from other personal finance experts, you know, that freezing is a good idea. But, you know, ultimately it doesn't solve the longer-term problem, which is at some point, you know, you're going to want to, you know, have others access your credit information, and then you have to constantly worry about freezing and unfreezing. And in some cases, you know, you might have a situation where it doesn't even occur to you that someone might need to check your credit records, you know, to open an account or to give you access to some service, and that becomes an inconvenience that you might run into difficulties where you've frozen your account, and there are businesses that are legitimate that do want to be able to check that information.
John in Green Bay is with us now. Hello, John.
Good morning, Joy. Josh, my question is, I froze my credit report several years ago at all three bureaus. What does that do to my credit score?
That's a great question. I am not a personal finance expert, but I suspect that it does nothing to your credit score. It shouldn't affect that, as long as, you know, all other things being equal and your payment history and accounts and all of those other things are in good standing. A freeze shouldn't be a negative, certainly, on your credit score.
Yeah. And again, you are not a financial planner. Marion Madison says she pays all her bills on time and feels that she's a good, you know, financial customer or consumer, but her credit score is still low, and wonders how the bureaus decide, you know, who gets a good score and who doesn't.
Well, I mean, it's complicated, and there are a lot of different variables. So, you know, without knowing the specifics of the case, but the credit score is based on your payment history in part. So, you know, whether you pay your bills, so that sounds like that's not a problem. But another aspect is your utilization. So, if you if you're using a lot of your credit, you're using it up to the maximum, and it looks like you don't have a lot of credit left, that can depress the score.
Yeah. Let's go to Lewis and Racine. Hi, Lewis.
Hi. How you doing?
Pretty good. What's your question?
Okay. I managed to freeze my credit with the other two bureaus, but I'm having a really, really, really hard time doing it with Equifax, which is ironic because they're the ones that are responsible for this. But I get the runaround. I call, and they want me to do everything online. I don't know how to use a computer. And also, that's where it originated, so I want to stay away from the computer. But then, I'm just having a real hard time. How can I do it? I did it over the phone with the other two.
Anyways, have you heard whether Equifax is being difficult about this, Josh?
I have not, but it doesn't surprise me. And, you know, one of the problems of these systems in general is that they're very impersonal. You know, everything is automated. It's very difficult to get a person on the phone to, you know, explain things. And so, you know, I think, again, it speaks to the larger frustration that consumers have trying to interact with these organizations, which, you know, really treat them as a secondary problem or as, you know, not their main concern.
Some U.S. senators, including Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Claire McCaskill, introduced legislation, Stop Errors in Credit Use and Reporting, or SECURE Act. It would apply standards to credit reporting agencies. It would require them to take steps to match consumers' names, addresses, and social security numbers. It also calls for better flow of information, such as clearer credit reports, which would help consumers better understand their credit and more easily fix errors. I know you're not a political scientist, but do you see this going anywhere?
Well, it's really important, and I hope that it's successful. And this is, you know, again, part of a longer effort for consumers and consumer advocates to get credit bureaus to be more helpful with consumers. For a long time, consumers were not even allowed to get a copy of their credit report. You weren't even allowed to see what was in the report. And then after that changed, if you wanted to see your report, you had to pay for it. So it's only been, you know, fairly recently that we have the ability to get a free copy of our credit report once a year. And that seems, you know, at minimum to be something we should expect. So, you know, the thinking and the the politics are moving in the direction of trying to help consumers make the bureaus more transparent and accommodating and helping consumers get their information. You know, I think that's completely reasonable.
Yeah. Donna from Glenwood City says that, among other things, she wants to know why it is the individual's responsibility to prove that a debt has been paid off. Apparently, is having trouble with that kind of thing.
Well, that's one of the most maddening things that people face when there's a problem with their credit information, if their identity has been stolen, that they have to go and prove to the bureaus that they are who they are, that they're not lying, that the account is, been resolved, or that it's not theirs. And, I've said it a few times, but again, it's, the bureaus are really working for businesses, and they view consumers as sort of, they view them warily, as possibly trying to pull one over on the bureau, pull one over on their creditors. So, if they're going to deal with consumers, it's often, presumption of guilt, and you have to prove your innocence. And, for most people, especially, when you're going through a traumatic situation of losing your identity or having people run up bills in your name, it feels especially unfriendly.
Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said yesterday that avoiding another Equifax-like breach is not something that corporations or private enterprises can do by themselves, that there's going to have to be private-public partnerships. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I'm not entirely sure what that means. If it means that that the private part can say that they're going to do a bunch of things, and the public part is that we trust them to self-regulate and to do the things that they say they're going to do, I'm more skeptical of that. But I mean, I think it's very clear that there need to be some consequences. There need to be some mechanisms in place to audit and to make sure that our information is secure. It's just unbelievable that a bureau could lose that much information and not have some sort of consequence or change in the way things are done to prevent that from ever happening again.
And do you have a 30-second takeaway for our listeners?
About the breach?
Yeah.
It's going to be a problem for all of us for a long time, and it's not just the credit bureaus, unfortunately. It's any organization that has information about us in a database. And like I said before, I mean, the main problem with credit bureaus is that it's compulsory, and if there's a problem, you can't just walk away and find a competitor that you trust more. So, we're really in a situation where we have to find ways to make the credit bureaus more accountable and more secure and more transparent.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Josh Lauer, author of Creditworthy, A History of Consumer Surveillance and Financial Identity in America. Thanks to Bill Martins and Akili Boltina for producing the program. This is the Ideas Network.